Welcome to those arriving today and those returning. Bodhidharma's Memorial Day. You may have heard the story of how he arrived in China and had this meeting with the Emperor of China somehow. Maybe it was unusual for Indians to come to China at that point. And it was a Buddhist emperor, so maybe he wanted to hear about this Indian Buddhism, maybe this new style that Bodhidharma was bringing. So they met and had a little conversation. And the emperor thought he was, as they talked, he thought more and more how strange is this character, and said, "Who are you, actually?" And Bodhidharma said, "I don't know." And the emperor apparently didn't understand, so Bodhidharma thought, "What can I say that's more clear and direct than that to help this emperor understand? I can't think of anything more clear and direct to say, so I'll just demonstrate it." And he said, "It's like this." And he went up to this cave and sat there facing the wall for 9 years. We don't know if the emperor actually noticed or not. But can hear that as just demonstrating the principle most directly, even more clearly than saying, "I don't know." He just sat there. Was he wondering? I wonder if anyone's getting this or not. Or was he just sitting, trusting that practice so much that with also the great vow that people will understand and benefit from such a teaching and practice, trusting that, just sat. And it looks like it did kind of work, because here we are today because of him sitting there. Yes.
How did you know when 9 years that was it.
Well, maybe that's why 9's kind of a random number. Maybe he didn't set out to sit for 9 years. He just, at some point, his legs got tired. But it just happened to be 9 years. Yeah. I don't know if there's any significance to that, but he just got up, and then later people, "Wow, he was there for 9 years? Did you know that, Bodhidharma?" And he said, "Oh, really? No, I just, my legs got tired and I need to use the toilet." So we're going through this transmission of light record, these stories of the Zen ancestors, of which Bodhidharma's kind of the really founder of Zen. We have all these Indian Zen ancestors, but at the time they didn't know it was Zen. So Bodhidharma didn't know either. But in a way, I think the particular style of Zen began with Bodhidharma. So it's nice that in this transmission of light sesshin, it's also Bodhidharma's memorial sesshin. So we're up to the ancestor Tosu Gise Daisho, and his story involves this older koan story. This was at the time in China when Zen people were using stories of earlier Zen ancestors to practice with. This is actually the earliest Zen ancestor, Shakyamuni Buddha, the story's about, but it's in the Koan collections. It's in both the Blue Cliff Record and the Gateless Barrier Koan collections. Case 65 in the Blue Cliff Record collection and case 32 in this Gateless Barrier. So the case, the story about Shakyamuni Buddha, a non-Buddhist, and I don't know if it matters who it is, but I think maybe they make that point that it's like, you know, a Brahmin or somebody who hasn't been practicing with the Buddha and doesn't know his teaching, but actually immediately gets it more clearly than Ananda, Buddha's foremost disciple who's always with him. So maybe that's why they say he's an outsider or someone from some other tradition, to kind of praise the Buddha's skillful means that anybody can get this immediately. Is that potential? So this non-Buddhist, outside the way, literally, are the characters they use. Ask the world-honored one, I do not ask for the spoken, I do not ask for the unspoken. Or, I don't ask about words, and I don't ask about no words. The world-honored one, in response, just sat still. Just like Bodhidharma. Great response. Maybe that's where Bodhidharma got it, from this story. So the question is, I don't ask about the spoken or the unspoken, or we could maybe put it like, what's your Dharma all about beyond words and no words, I think is the meaning. And the world-honored one just sat there silently. And then this questioner praised him, saying, the world-honored one with his great compassion and mercy has opened the clouds of my delusion and enabled me to enter the way. He then made bows and took his leave. So he had some insight, some awakening, some dropping off of his previous views. Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, who is always there, recording all these stories, asked, what did that non-Buddhist realize to make him praise you? The world-honored one said, he's like a fine horse who runs even at the shadow of the whip. Image, right, of the horse rider, the horse standing there about to give a little whack to the horse to make it run. So just the shadow, as the whip starts to approach, the horse is like, oh, it's time to run, don't even bother striking me. All I need is the slight little, tiniest little hint. So that's like, this person understood the Buddha with the tiniest little hint, called the Buddha just sitting there silently. So this is a little bit from Robert Aitken Roshi in his commentary on this story. And he brings up the Blue Cliff Record commentary, which says, though the fine sword is in its scabbard, its light is sharp and cold. So that's like poetic celebration of the Buddha just sitting there. His wisdom sword, well, 84,000 Dharma teachings that he spoke in volumes and volumes of sutras, that sword is in its scabbard when he's just sitting there silently with lips sealed. Though the fine sword, the Buddha's fine Dharma sword, is put away in its scabbard, its light is sharp and cold. Nice verse to celebrate the Buddha's Dharma teaching and to celebrate Bodhidharma's teaching of sitting facing the wall. His fine sword is in its scabbard for 9 years. When Manjushri asked Vimalakirti about the Dharma gate of non-duality, Vimalakirti responded without drawing his sword. Do you know this story? We're kind of like weaving down the, comments upon comments here a little bit, but I thought this is worth bringing up in case you haven't heard. To celebrate Bodhidharma today and to celebrate the Buddha's teaching in this story, Vimalakirti is this great awakened, clear layman in India who the monks are all afraid to go talk to because he's so wise and clear, and it's so embarrassing to see how they don't understand as deeply as this ordinary person living in the world. So this became an important sutra for Zen, the Vimalakirti Sutra. And this is one of the kind of highlights in chapter 9, the chapter on the Dharma gate of non-duality. Dharma gates are boundless. We're about to enter them. And one of them we're about to enter is the Dharma gate of non-duality, non-separation between subject and object, between any sense of this and that duality. So this is basically, the chapter starts with Vimalakirti saying to the congregation of bodhisattvas, "Sirs, how does the bodhisattva enter the Dharma gate of non-duality? Each of you explain this as you wish." And then it's a great list of many bodhisattvas giving these wonderful teachings about how they understand how to enter the gate of non-duality for several pages. A bunch of different bodhisattvas. And here's just the last few. Jewel Seal Hand Bodhisattva said, "To delight in nirvana and not to delight in the world of samsara constitutes a duality, doesn't it? If one does not delight in nirvana and does not have aversion for the world of samsara, then there's no duality. Why? If there is bondage, then there is emancipation. If there is fundamentally no bondage, who would seek emancipation? Without bondage or emancipation, then there's no delighting or aversion. This is to enter the Dharma gate of non-duality." Of course, we can take every word of the sutras as a kind of zazen instruction, practice, life instruction. So we might be in Sesshin wishing for just a little bit of nirvana, a little bit of peace, freedom, all this struggle and churning of the mind, just some rest from it all. But that sets up this duality. Without the ideas of being stuck in samsara or freed into nirvana, then there's no delighting in nirvana or aversion to samsara. This is to enter the Dharma gate of non-duality. Crown of pearls, King Bodhisattva said, the correct path and the heterodox paths constitute a duality. The true way and the false practices that don't really work, you could say, constitute a duality. Those who abide in the correct path do not discriminate between the heterodox and the correct. So the true path doesn't make a distinction between the true path and the false path. That's what the true path is. To transcend this duality is to enter the Dharma gate of non-duality. Delights in the real, Bodhisattva said, the real and the unreal constitute a duality. To really see is to not see reality, and how much more so the not real. Why? That which the physical eye cannot see can be seen by the wisdom eye, but this wisdom eye is without seeing and without not seeing. This is to enter the Dharma gate of non-duality. So, real and unreal is a delusion, even though this is the teaching of delights in the real Bodhisattva. Says, actually, let's not make a distinction between real and not real. After the various Bodhisattvas have thus each made their explanations, Vimalakirti asked Manjushri, the great wisdom hero, Bodhisattva, how does the Bodhisattva enter the Dharma gate of non-duality? Manjushri said, as I understand it, it's to be without words and without explanation with regard to all the dharmas, without manifestation, without consciousness, and transcending all questions and answers. This is to enter the Dharma gate of non-duality. All these Bodhisattvas were speaking, and Manjushri purposely didn't. So he's like, so Vimalakirti can call on me last, and I can give the best answer, to be without words and without explanation. Manjushri then asked Vimalakirti, well, we have each made our own explanations, just as you asked us. Now, Vimalakirti, you should explain how the Bodhisattva enters the Dharma gate of non-duality. At this point, Vimalakirti was silent, saying nothing. Manjushri exclaimed, excellent, excellent! Not to even have words or speech at all is the true entrance into the Dharma gate of non-duality. When this discourse on entering the Dharma gate of non-duality was explained, 5,000 bodhisattvas within the congregation all entered the Dharma gate of non-duality and attained forbearance of the non-arising of dharmas. You can see why this became one of the favorite Zen sutras for chapters like that. So, Shakyamuni Buddha, the world honored one, Vimalakirti, and Bodhidharma, all carry on such a direct pointing and we too here in Sesshin, we might feel like, well, is there anybody outside who can hear this profound Dharma that we're expounding as we sit silently? And maybe we trust that it's heard inconceivably by this world. So, Robert Aitken says, when Manjushri asked Vimalakirti about the Dharma gate of non-duality, Vimalakirti responded without drawing his sword. No words truly have an effect, as Wu Men, this collector, points out elsewhere. But if, as Yuan Wu in the Blue Cliff Record says, the point is not just being quiet, what is it that cleared the clouds of delusion from this non-Buddhist's mind? As Ananda asks, what did that outside the way person see to make him praise you? Well, he saw the Buddha at rest, Aitken Roshi says. It's not just being quiet, he saw the Buddha at rest. It's this rest that we miss in philosophy and in philosophers. He tells this little story. At the 1949 East-West Philosophers Conference at the University of Hawaii, Dr. D.T. Suzuki fascinated his Western colleagues not by what he said, because they didn't understand it, his strange Zen talk, but by how he said it. He was at ease, at rest. I think Dr. Suzuki's colleagues sensed in him the rest that clears the clouds, the rest that levels mountains to the plains, the rest that grows oats, peas, beans, and barley. Buddhism is called the religion of peace, and Shakyamuni presents that peace here. It's not the kind of do-nothing peace, safe and uneventful. It's the radical casting away of body and mind. It's the experience of the vast, fathomless void that's potent with all things and all possibilities. Is there a kind of like, was Bodhidharma doing like do nothing kind of Zen? I'll just sit here. Or was he like radiating great light that makes the world turn and the stars bright? So, Tosu Gise. His story is that he studied with Fushan Yuanzhen, and Yuanzhen had him investigate this story of the non-Buddhist asking the Buddha, aside from speech, aside from silence, the whole story that we just heard. After 3 years, one day Yuanzhen asked him, "Do you remember that case? Do you still remember that story?" "Try to present it." Totsu was just about to speak when Yuanzhen put his hand over Totsu's mouth. And Totsu was thoroughly enlightened. So it's a story about speech and silence. Do you remember that story that I told you in words about words and silence? Try to present it to me now. And it worked. In the earlier story, Kate, this is Keizan Zenji, our writer of the Transmission of Light record. In the earlier story, the non-Buddhist asks the Buddha, aside from speech, aside from silence, what is it? Since it is a path which simply does not fall into the extremes of speech and silence, the world-honored one was silent for a while. This is not hidden or revealed, not self or other, not within or without, not relative or ultimate. When it was revealed as like space or like the water in the vast ocean, the non-Buddhist suddenly understood. The Blue Cliff Record has the same story with its own little commentary and a verse to celebrate the story. And part of the verse that expressing Buddha's silence in the story, Shui Do writes these verses, says, a clear mirror is suddenly leaned on a stand and immediately distinguishes beautiful and ugly. So, naturally I couldn't resist bringing up that part. So far each of these stories is bringing up the mirror metaphor, just coincidentally. So I thought that's interesting that the poetic celebration of Buddha's silence is like this, to teach this question or something. Buddha's silence is like this clear mirror. That nothing sticks to and doesn't block anything. Mirror doesn't say anything or prefer anything, and isn't trying to do anything, and yet everything is totally apparent in the mirror. When it was so, this questioner bowed, saying, the world-honored one in his great compassion has lifted the cloud of my delusion and helped me enter the truth. Having said that, he left. He was able, Keizan says now, he was able to become like the great purity of the sky when not a fragment of cloud remains, like the stillness of the great ocean when the winds die down. However, Ananda did not understand, and he respectfully asked the Buddha, what did that non-Buddhist attain so he could speak of entering? That non-Buddhist. Because I'm a Buddhist, so I should like... Yes. The Buddha replied, he's like an excellent horse who goes when he sees the shadow of the whip. This is the means employed by Buddha ancestors. In personally making the treasury of each individual open, thorough awakening appears and total clarity arrives without a single device being used or a single word being spoken. It's like seeing the shadow of the whip and reaching the true road. Sometimes Dharma teaching is so extremely simple, and then, you know, people like me can make it really complicated, going on and on. So what's underneath all these complicated words? Words are just for fun, because it's, you know, it's on the schedule as a Dharma talk. We could have scheduled it as as shorter and not two times a day. But I thought, I in my little crazy mind thought, like, it'd be really fun to just like jabber away for like hours and hours every day about not much. About the shadow of the whip. But this is just a nice story that probably is where the image comes from. The Buddha used this phrase, shadow of the whip, in the Anguttara Nikaya, Aiken Roshi quotes. Because it's nice, a little bit unrelated, but a great teaching story to remember from the early sutras. The Buddha says, "The one who learns that someone in another village is about to die and reflects on the transient nature of all life is like a horse who runs when it sees the shadow of the whip." Some stranger in a nearby town, you hear, oh, someone's sick and is going to die, and to really realize impermanence directly, myself here and now, kind of like, I'm going to die. Taking this like to heart in a very intimate, personal way. It's like a horse who runs when it sees the shadow of the whip. The one who learns that someone in his own village is about to die and reflects on the impermanent nature of all life is like a horse who runs when the whip hits its hair. Not just the shadow, but just the whip brushes its hair. The one who learns that someone in his family is about to die and reflects on the impermanent nature of all life is like a horse who runs when it's whipped to the flesh. And finally, the one who learns that he himself is about to die and reflects on the impermanent nature of all life is like a horse who runs when it's whipped to the bone. Yeah. We're here for such a short time. And what's the running? What's the horse's running, do you think? At either the shadow of the whip or the whip striking to the core.
Our effort and our practice.
Yeah, it's our effort and practice. Mm-hmm. So here's some distant stranger in a far place is dying, or just the very idea of impermanence motivates us to practice more sincerely. And I think we see this in the world of people who don't have maybe a spiritual practice at all. It often is when they're dying, right? When they're on their deathbed, they finally, okay. There's something important happening here. Let's take up some kind of spirituality. So,
Stuckey's mindless.
Yes.
So calm, so forthright.
Yeah, I was very impressed with his Dharma teaching. Abbot Nyogen Steve Stuckey, the Abbot of San Francisco Zen Center, just got diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. He's not that old either, and he's a pretty healthy guy. I think big surprise. And he sent around an email to folks saying, "This is the diagnosis. I'm going into the doctor. I think without treatment, I'd have a few months with chemotherapy, maybe extended to a year." And then he put some Dharma quotes. It was a Dogen poem, something like, a dewdrop shaken from a crane's bill in the morning light. That is this fleeting life. Is like that. A little dewdrop on the bill, without a second thought of how insignificant and fleeting. And then he quoted Blind Lemon Jefferson. Steve Stuckey is a great blues singer and guitar player. Loves to sing the blues. And I don't know how the tune goes. Does anyone know? Something like, feel like I'm fixing to die. Feel like I'm fixing to die. I don't mind dying, but I hate to leave my children crying. And I knowing Yogan, I feel like, I imagine he really does feel like that. I think he's very equanimous. I'm sure he wouldn't choose to die, but I think there's a sense in which I can, through his deep practice, I can imagine that okay, here we go, big practice opportunity. And it's okay, it's my time, but my family, you know, they're not practicing so intently. They have their own life, but even if they were, I think they'd have a much harder time than me. I think that's often how it goes, which is kind of beautiful. That we care more about other people than ourselves. And it almost naturally, sometimes it's like this, at least within families. Very practical, very like just responding, right? Suzuki Roshi, I heard when he was dying, he had various internal pains and all, and no one was sure what it was that he had. And I think that the doctors suspected it was hepatitis, I think, as I recall the story. This is contagious, so they kind of quarantined him and didn't want his students to hang around. Is hepatitis contagious like that? Yeah, I think that's how the story goes. And then he went to more doctors and eventually they said, oh, it's actually not hepatitis, it's cancer, and it's, you know, worse than we thought. And you don't have much longer. And Suzuki Roshi was like, oh, I'm so glad that it's not contagious. Now my students can come back in. I can be with people again now. That's how you know. And let's take care of it, if people want to give me treatments and so on, it's okay. But not too like worked up about, you know, we don't know internally how the deep emotions are, like, but wonderful practice example. It's like seeing the shadow of the whip and reaching the true road. Thus, do not get stuck in the realm of no thought. I think he's now pointing out this Buddha's silence. Let's not take that in a kind of one-sided way of just like, I mean, if we should never speak again, if we really want to practice, let's not ever, let's just cut off the mind. Let's get a lobotomy, cut off the tongue. Thus, do not get stuck in the realm of no thought, but continue to use your eyes, or another translation is, but continue to see beyond this realm of no thought. Do not get attached to speechlessness, but continue to clarify mind. Many people misunderstand this silence of the Buddha. They say, when a single thought does not occur, the whole mind is revealed. The whole being is revealed. When one goes beyond the forms of names, it is bared spontaneously, just as a mountain is exposed when all the clouds are gone. One is resolutely independent of all things, exactly like this. So many people misunderstand and say things like that, which, as usual, you know, sounds pretty good, actually, I always think. So he's always pointing at the great subtleties. If you compare this kind of statement, with one's former intellectual understanding and galloping about seeking for it externally, there seems to be a little rest. But one still has not forgotten skin and flesh, nor has ordinary perception or consciousness departed. If you want to be fit for this realm, try to end your panting breath and sever the life force, or sever your attachment to life. When you see what is exposed, how can you say it's non-thought? Since you cannot say it's anything, how can you even say it is silence? It is not just the cessation of panting breath and the eyes closing. Look at that place where the 100 bones are scattered and not a remnant of skin and flesh remains. Like your original face before this body was born. There is something which is neither light nor darkness, and is neither male nor female. This is, and in the English translation, something has a capital S. So Kazan likes to express that there is this inconceivable something, which is not light or darkness, neither male nor female, neither silent or noisy, neither this nor that. But it's not just no thought. How can I communicate this principle? The outline of a peak so high that birds can hardly cross, sword blades and thin ice, who can walk on them? Extremely subtle. A mountain peak so high birds can hardly cross. Sword blades and thin ice, who can walk on them? And he seems to be this is Kazan's verse, seems to be referring to Wu Men's verse in the Mu Man Kan, about this story of the neither speech nor silence. So it seems like these ancients were constantly cross-referencing other related Zen stories. So Wu Men's verse in the Mu Man Kan on this says, walking on a sword blade, running on thin ice. Without going through any steps, he lets go over a cliff. I think he's referring to this to this non-Buddhist who understands at the shadow of the whip. Something like, way he's listening, way he's asking this question to the Buddha and receiving the Buddha's zazen is like walking on a sword blade, running on thin ice, and therefore, without going through any steps or complicated teachings, he just lets go over a cliff and is free. That's the end of the long story of Tosu Gisei and his the way he was able to carry on the Soto Zen lineage, practicing with a teacher from the Rinzai lineage, who was held the Soto cover for Taiyo Kyogen, so he could pass it on. The 45th ancestor was Zen teacher Dao Kai of Mount Fujung, Fuyo Dokai Daiyosho, who was considered a great reviver of Soto Zen school in China, which is interesting that the lineage almost died out just the generation before. For those who are here and heard this story, there was like no successor, so this previous ancestor had to entrust his dharma to this other teacher to pass it on, just to keep it from dying out. And then just a couple of generations later, Fuyo Dokai, like, with his skillful means, really like revives the spirit of Soto Zen and helps it flourish. It looks like, and the way he did that was partly through his really kind of strict practice. I don't know all the details. Let me try to find out more. Was it his strict practice that was what made it flourish? Or just his sincerity and wisdom? When we bow in the morning to the Doshi, when we're reciting the names of all the ancestors, there's particular ancestors where the Doshi bows, like does prostrations, because it's certain like peaks in the mountain range that are that particularly stand out.
How were those decided upon?
Well, I don't know, but we look in our stories, I think in the stories of these ancestors we see certain peaks, like. Part of it also may be that it happens to be just around the right place to make the bowing very even. That if you just keep bowing very slowly and steadily, you hit these ancestors. So is that part of the principle of the way this thing works? Is that that this transmission of light is kind of like a, what are those instruments that measure like a heartbeat? There's like, they go like this, boom, boom, boom. Could be that the lineage of transmission of light is like this. So, Shakyamuni Buddha, of course, right? Vasumitra, in the old Indian days, those Indian ancestors are, we don't know how that list exactly came to be, but Vasumitra was an important Abhidharma compiler, this Mahavibhasha Abhidharma treatise. So, is that Zen? He's a Zen ancestor, but he is known for this, for an important, I think to us in modern times, quite obscure text, Nagarjuna. No one can argue. Some people call him the second Buddha. Not just in Zen, but in all of Mahayana, Nagarjuna is one of the great peaks. Vasubandhu, co-founder of the Yogacara school, very important. And the names, by the way, in between these other ones, I never heard of them. So next is Bodhidharma. Well, of course, Bodhidharma. Next is the sixth ancestor, Daikan Inno Daisho, who all his first six ancestors were quite important, but the sixth ancestor is almost like the founder of Zen, you know, in, along with Bodhidharma, of which all the lineages branched forth after Daikan Inno. It's Tozan Ryokai, or Dongshan, who is the founder of the Dongshan lineage. After Dongshan, these are his prostrations, right? It's Fuyo Dokai. This, you know, who's, I think compared to all those previous ones, he's maybe the least known. But as I understand it, he was this reviver, and we have some poems. Some of his, one I'll read you later, kind of sort of statement of his sometimes gets chanted at Soto Zen temples in Japan. And after him is you know, Tendo Nyojo and Eihei Dogen through Dogen through Keizan. We stay prostrated. And after that, all the Soto Zen lineages branch out in myriad directions, and we the Doshi bows randomly. Yeah, kind of, again, evenly, kind of evenly spaced. And actually, those ancestors we know very little about, are particularly like Suzuki Roshi lineage. I think Koban's lineage diverges pretty quickly. I think maybe it's even Gassan Joseki. I think it divides them. Do Koban folks know if it's? I think it's Meiho Sotetsu. Anyway, those lineages branch out. Yeah, so all Soto Zen lineages are this transmission of light through Keizan. But Keizan, our collector here, is the mutual ancestor. After him, it goes wild. Not that wild, I guess, right away. It's like a tree, right? So Gassan Joseki and Meiho Sotetsu and maybe like one other of Keizan's disciples has like a branch that continues to the present. The 45th ancestor was Zen teacher Dao Kai, or Wei Formality. Dokai or Dao Kai. Formality of the Way of Mount Fudong, or Peony Flower Mountain. He studied with priest Totsu Iching, the previous ancestor, whose mouth was covered when he tried to speak. He asked him, so Fuyo Dokai asked his teacher, "The words of the Buddhas and ancestors are like ordinary rice and tea," which is kind of like just a Chinese colloquial phrase meaning like very ordinary stuff. Because in China and Japan, even in modern times, like everybody has rice, maybe like almost every meal, and just drinks green tea through the day. They're like the staples of these cultures. And, you know, not special fancy rice and tea, but just ordinary rice and tea. Household stuff, just like daily nourishment. The words of the Buddhas and ancestors are like ordinary rice and tea. They're actually not so special. But is there anything else apart from these to help people? Do you have a sense for that kind of question? I myself have, you know, before I even heard this story, such types of questions would arise in my mind. Like, we hear all these Dharma teachings, right? And like, yeah, they're great and they're helpful, but there must be something more than these teachings that we hear to really, like, really wake us up. Especially we just keep hearing the same things often over and over. It's like, you know, unsurpassed supreme enlightenment. So exalted, so mysterious. And then we have instructions like, just sit and like let go of thinking. Really? I'm talking about like unsurpassed enlightenment? We have many other instructions too, but they're often, especially, you know, maybe like things like the Sandhita Mochana Sutra, something might sound like not so much like ordinary rice and tea. So I'd say, oh, maybe it's hidden in these complex teachings somehow. But the words of the Zen ancestors tend to be quite ordinary, actually. That's the style of Zen, is very straightforward. Sometimes, you know, the straightforwardness is very poetic and unusual. But it's always trying to point very directly. Yes?
Well, perhaps because the word intimate is used in a lot of sutras, that the intimacy of the teachings, the way they're passed on, makes the ancestors important. And that's what we're, you know, responding to. Perhaps, and saying their names.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. It's about intimacy, very direct, and we try to express it directly. And when you bring up like the sutras and the ancestors, somebody, maybe Jeff, the other day asked about where did this kind of lineage thing come from, and why is it, and do other schools have this thing, and why is it so important in Zen? Because it's a big theme of these teachings, is about this lineage of teachings. And I came across something since then that one explanation is that there were these other schools of Buddhism in China before Zen, and they were, each of them was generally based on some sutra of the Buddha, or some text. All the schools were text-based on some particular thing. There was even a Vinaya school that was based on the Buddha's like monastic precept teachings. There was an Abhidharma school based on the Abhidharma teachings. There was a school based on Vasumitra's Mahavibhasha Abhidharma text, actually. I think in China, too. And then there were these Mahayana schools. The Huayan school is based on the Avatamsaka Sutra. The Chiantai school is based on the Lotus Sutra. And the Pure Land school is based on the Pure Land Sutra. That's maybe all of them. So there were all these different schools of Buddhism in, by the time things got to China, and each one of them is based on a particular text. And then Zen comes along and says, we're actually like a separate transmission outside the scriptures. Beyond, Bodhidharma said this, beyond words and letters, pointing directly to the human mind, seeing Buddha nature and becoming Buddha. So that was like the Zen thing. It's like the first school is like not based on a particular like scripture from India. Basically the scripture, they're all like attributed to Shakyamuni Buddha, all of them, those texts. So they all have this direct link to Shakyamuni Buddha because the school's practice is based on Shakyamuni Buddha's scriptural teaching. And Zen says, well, we don't need that. Or we don't need to rely on that. And this story is going to point this out too. And therefore, will anybody take us seriously? Because that was the style of Buddhism in China, is it has to be scripturally based. It has to rely on the authority of Shakyamuni Buddha, or it's maybe not even Buddhism, actually. So these Zen people were like doing something really radical, saying it's a separate transmission outside the sutras that just is this direct pointing. And to be legitimate, so that people would take them somewhat seriously in the early days, like, well, we need some way to connect to Shakyamuni Buddha other than a sutra. And because it's this direct pointing is about the intimacy between people, let's make our connection, intimate personal connections, going back to Shakyamuni Buddha, called like a lineage of warm hand to warm hand. So I think that's a nice story of why Zen emphasizes this lineage maybe more than Pure Land and Huayan and so on. They maybe also have theirs, and maybe in response to the Zen people, like, oh, we want that too. Like, well, can we use some of those same Indian ancestors? Yes.
Mm-hmm. So many of us couldn't understand, well, a lot of us couldn't understand. He had such broken English, but there was some way that he reached where we lived, or helped us rise to that occasion, even without understanding his words. And even he used to do a lot trying to find the English word, was the pause, the pregnant pause. To bring people along, and I wasn't the only one that obviously felt that way, because you have such a difficulty speaking English, being understood, and yet what? So that same pointing.
Yeah, being together. Yeah. There's a kind of energetic transmission.
Yes, because you felt like he was speaking to you personally.
And maybe his just feeling of intimacy, and like we're sharing Dharma together. If we don't understand all the words, that's okay, because it's just a way to be together. So even when his teaching, I'm sure in his later life his English was probably quite good, but even these early talks, like from the Zen Center that I've heard, his English is quite good. But he also has a very, like, kind of mystical, I would say, way of talking. So even if you understand the English, still what he's actually talking about is often, what is this actually about here? I sometimes wonder.
Wait, so you had all that scholastic background, but you also had that very mystical.
Yeah. Poetic, too, yeah.
Feeling that we had for him was transmitted to everyone in the sangha, so that the feeling of intimacy, even if you weren't really friends with someone, was felt. And, you know, to this day, you know, the people that were practicing together, I think, still feel that way about each other. And so it's almost like the transmission is not like this, but it's more like a net connection.
Wide circle.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a sense of that. That was his style. Mm-hmm. Like that.
And somehow encourage you to be just who you were in that too.
Mm-hmm.
beyond what you thought you could for a whole life.
Mm.
Somehow that model.
Yeah. Yeah. Practicing together. Just practicing together. It's, you know, day by day, simple ways is, I think it's the main thing always, right? And then, you know, there's talk and study and more complicated things, but they're kind of secondary. Yeah. It's beautiful to, you know, as someone who didn't know Copen very well myself, I feel, and I, you know, I can't tell how much of it is my projection and how much of it is some just fragrance or something left behind. But just practicing in this place, I often think of Copen and kind of like feel sort of his kind of spirit and energy here. It changed so much too, right? It's, you know, all, everything's so rebuilt and everything's got more formalized. And yet there's something about just this space that's like has some resonance, yeah, yeah. I wish he could come back and be here.
Yeah, I feel like that, especially
feel like connected to you. And you all being here, I think, is, as you know, direct students of Copen is great for this place, I think. And Peter and Bill and people who practice closely with him, it's I think it's important, you know, to keep that alive. And we keep doing Copen's monthly memorials and so on, so. So, Furyo Dokai asks Totsu Gisei, the words of the Buddha ancestors are like ordinary rice and tea, but is there anything else apart from these to help people? Please, what could there be? Totsu said, you tell me, does the emperor's mandate in his kingdom depend on the ancient emperors? Yao, Shun, Yu, and Tang, who are in China considered these great, especially Yao and Shun, are often brought up as like these really like virtuous and wise emperors from distant antiquity, models for being an emperor. So these words of the ancestors are like ordinary tea and rice. Is there anything apart from these to help people? So you tell me, does the emperor, the present emperor's mandate or commands in his kingdom depend on these ancient virtuous ancestors, Yao, Shun, Yu, and Tang? Does the present emperor need to rely on these ancients to benefit his country? Furyo was about to answer when, for the third time in a row, Totsu struck him in the mouth with his fly whisk, mouthful of hair, and said, when you gave way to thought, you immediately deserved 30 blows. And Furyo was awakened. So, I do think it's interesting that three generations in a row of these ancestors all have the same principle. They're about to speak, and the teacher basically cuts them off. And that's their awakening. Interesting. And in this case, he actually says it more clearly. When you gave way to thought, that made you be about to speak, you immediately deserve 30 strikes with the staff. Just common Zen saying. 30 blows. Like, the slightest dualistic thought arising about this is going off track. And this is a story, seems to be about in the present day, in order to help people, do we need to rely on these ancient teachings or not? So it came up a little bit on a previous day about this question of following, keeping the ancient tradition alive to help people versus like adapting and changing and not relying on the old way, and the tension between those. So I think we can hear this as a story about that too, because this is ancestors talking about previous ancestors, Kazan writing a whole book about previous ancestors, and here we have this story. Does the present emperor need to rely on these great beings in the past to give his mandate in the present? So now the circumstances, the background story. The master's name was Dao Kai. Even as a youth, he enjoyed peace and quiet, secluding himself on Mount Yiyang. Later, he traveled to the capital and registered at Dai Shu Monastery, where he examined the Lotus Sutra and became a monk. He called on Totsu at Hai Hui Monastery. He asked this, the words of the Buddha ancestors are like ordinary tea and rice, and so on, and was awakened. And then, right after his awakening, with a whisk in his mouth, he bowed several times and started to go. Tosu said, "Wait, come here a minute." But Dao Kai did not turn around. Tosu said, "Did you arrive at the realm of no doubt?" Fuyo covered his ears with his hands and kept walking out. I love this story. Again, I think an interesting theme is this tension, this fine line between confidence and arrogance. It's like his teacher's like, "Wait a second." And it's like, you know, "No, I don't want to hear anymore. I'm done." You know, "You helped me. You woke me up, teacher. But like, end of conversation." Because my life now does not depend on you and your old teachings. Did you reach the realm of no doubt? I don't even want to hear the question. So it's about trust, too. I think about trusting oneself. Like, this is a story about trusting oneself, which is also interesting, kind of like tension point here. What is it to trust oneself? Because, you know, we're so deluded. You know, like, I think that this is the way to do it, and I totally trust myself. Well, but is that just like holding a fixed idea? So, or is it, so what is the self that we're trusting? That's the question. Are we trusting the true self of the signless Buddha nature? Are we trusting our habitual self? Maybe some of both, and maybe it kind of wavers back. We start to trust the Buddha nature, and then we can't stand not like putting a little bit of a sign on it, and then, and kind of like marking this trust, and then we, And now we can say, I trust it like this. And now we have a position already to kind of... Yeah.
I think there's a dose I think that the other side of that kind of confidence is willingness to fall on their face. It's like, you know, all our vows or acting at all with confidence, you also have to be humbly willing to fall on your face.
That's a kind of confidence, actually.
The same way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, I think, a great point.
Maybe I just say that because I fall on my face all the time, but I think it's, you know.
But there's a way.
We make these arrogant vows because we know that we can't.
Mm. But there's a way, are you also saying that there's a way to confidently fall on one's face? Like there's falling on one's face and not, and feeling like, I better like hide that because I feel so bad about it. Right? And that's like not really confidence in ourselves, right? Whereas we're like, it's time to fall on my face. And like, because that's what's, the entire universe is supporting me to fall on my face right now. And therefore I deeply trust that this fall is exactly what's meant to be happening now. Hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And willing to be a fool. Yeah, willing to be a fool, idiot. Yes.
And perhaps this trusting is the acknowledgement that only you can do it.
Mm.
No one else can do it for you.
Mm. Yes. Yeah. Both fall and stand up.
Whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
It's up to you.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And being confident or not confident.
Yeah.
Either.
Yeah, yeah, and that truly there's nothing at all to rely on.
No.
Except, yeah, no place to hide, and you know, nothing to rely on but ourself. But again, I would like capital S self, like nothing to rely on but our big self that includes everyone and everything. There's nothing outside ourself to rely on. Mm-hmm. And I think that was maybe part of this question. Is there some, you know, these ordinary words that we hear to help people, is there something else we can rely on here? Like, can't like Buddha come give us the magic wand or something that like that can really, that we can really help people? And that that whole way of thinking is off track.
There's nothing to rely on
of reality.
Reality.
Yeah. With nothing to rely on. No thing to rely on. Depends on everything,
yeah.
Relies on everything, but all that the Buddha depends on and relies on is not outside herself. So in the Dharma gate of non-duality, then there can be all kinds of like falling on faces and happiness and misery and everything in between, all in the one sphere of interdependent reality with nothing outside it. And we keep thinking, what about just a little, is even this whole sphere of reality that's so messy and beautiful and everything, what about just, can't we just get a little bit outside it and find the secret key? I think of that, there's the old, a Christian woodblock print of Ezekiel? Was it the vision of Ezekiel? Was it Ezekiel who saw the cosmic wheels? Do you know about this story?
I don't know anything about Ezekiel.
That's a blues song. Ezekiel saw the wheel.
Is it?
Is it a blues song? Oh, I don't mind.
Cool, cool. Well, there's...
That's all I know.
I think some...
I just made that song.
You just made it.
Is that true?
Yeah.
And it's
so true.
It's like it's the a gospel song.
Could be, yeah. Well,
mm-hmm.
But Ezekiel, I think, is a old prophet, maybe?
Yes.
Yeah.
Old Testament
prophet. And I think there's something about the cosmic wheels or like the workings of the universe, what make the universe tick, right? And he has like a vision of the cosmic wheels. But I've seen this old woodblock print. I actually had a t-shirt of it. In my, I don't have it anymore. In my hippie days, I thought it was a really cool image because it's like Ezekiel's like the shepherd crawling along the ground at night with his shepherd's staff and over the hills, and there's a little village down below in the distance, and it's a starry night and all the stars are out, and then it's like the stars are on this kind of like semicircle sphere of I think they maybe did think the sky was like that in the old days. It's like almost like a planetarium, but it's got an edge. The stars are like on the surface of this edge of this, and it was like it was like poking through the sphere of sky was these actual like wheels, turning cosmic wheels. We're kind of like poking through, and Ezekiel's on the ground, like looking up.
I have a t-shirt like that. With that on it.
Really?
Yeah, it's a big one. It's been around.
Oh. Yeah. Do you still have it?
I don't think I have it.
I haven't seen it anyway. I have found the image on the internet since then.
Oh, you should send it.
Yeah, send it around. Yeah. But why did I think of this?
Prince of
Shirts. Yeah, Santa Cruz Zen Center.
Holy Cross is right there. Well, because it's right.
I thought Ezekiel was a Japanese name.
Ezekiel. But I thought of it as kind of like an image of like the delusion that we think we're like Ezekiel, like lurking for these cosmic wheels that are actually like outside of reality, right? They're poking through from this some other realm out there. And so we know all the stuff within this sphere, all these stars and buildings and sheep in this sphere. But isn't there something apart from this stuff to help people? Like the cosmic wheels. The cosmic wheels. And they're like, they're like outside the edge there. And Ezekiel's vision is like somehow he saw that they poked through the cosmic wheels. I don't think it's like that. I think koan is like, can't we find the cosmic wheels for Yodokai out there? And he says, tell me, do you think that... that everybody who's helping making this universe tick needs some cosmic wheels out there? Do you think the Zen ancestors needed cosmic wheels? Or did they just drink tea and have rice, actually, in order to help people? Yes?
Well, this is kind of... this whole time that we've been sitting here, I've been really thinking about the importance of listening.
Hmm.
Listening with our ears, listening with more than our ears. A number of things that you've said made me think about, but that, like sometimes when something's over our mouth, we need to be quiet because we need to be listening to what somebody else has to say. But also,
or silence.
About, yes, the importance of, well, so what is not the universe telling us? What are other people's experiences telling us? What is our experience telling us? So that when we decide to do something that may be a mistake, we're willing to do. I don't know about confidence and arrogance, because I sit on the arrogant side. So I don't want to trust anything there. but that, you know, if you've listened deeply, and it is it's kind of whole body listening deeply enough, you kind of know you're willing to do it, you know, from inside you, you're willing to do it, even if it's right or wrong, because that seems like.
Yeah. I think that's a very beautiful way of talking about the integration between relying on, we might be talking about the ancients, but even in the present day, relying on others and the world, and at the same time being totally kind of like free to make your mandate in the world. And so you listen to Yao and Shun, the ancient kings, and you listen to the present kings and all of that, and openly, and then within that openness to lots of different input, then you freely, in a way, without really relying on any of that, you freely express yourself. It's a nice integration, because that doesn't mean I freely, you know, I don't want to hear you all, I'm just going to like do my thing and say my thing. That's not it. And then just saying, I don't, you know, I better not have any opinion at all. I just like, you guys tell me the way, then that's not quite it either. Right? So I think the way you said it is very nice.
And then ultimately it's a listening to yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, listening to yourself with this great openness that includes everything. Yeah. Yeah, this is definitely the kind of thing that never stops. Because the light keeps getting transmitted along endlessly. Can't be put in a dark box. So. Yeah, yeah. And together, the whole event of the symphony is one whole event. You can't even say that it's for anyone. It's just a happening. Mm-hmm. It's just a expression from all sides. Each has their role, including the... I guess they probably don't sell popcorn at the symphony, right? Mm-hmm. Wine or something. Including the wine seller. Is that necessary Dharma position in the symphony?
this tea and rice that we keep coming back to, you know, it's just this body and mind that we, you know, look at again and again.
Yeah.
Coming here to Sashimi, or, you know, that can be comfortable, or that really puts us in sort of a, you know, a whole 5 days worth of forms.
Snake in a bamboo tube.
you know, somehow we keep coming back to that ordinary teen lives of our lives. And it's the,
you know, nice.
Very powerful.
Yeah. Body and mind.
I've said this story before, but you know, early in practice, you know, 20 some years ago, we would go to Jukoji for these sashimis, and you know, Catherine, you know, just had this way of making this practice feel so important, you know, just this sitting down.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, all these planes go over to Koji on the way to San Jose.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to think, you know, if there's going to be these lucky planes that are just lucky enough to go over this spot, they're going to feel something great as they fly over to Koji. We're all just sitting there. So.
Yeah, we sit for the people in the airplanes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that, I really appreciate, is there anything apart from ordinary body and mind, or is there anything apart from our ordinary experience to help people? That's like, like the cosmic wheels outside our ordinary experience. We don't need to rely on anything special other than our direct experience in the moment. Yeah. And that's how we help people. Even just to like, me just sitting here like in pain for another period, how is this helping anyone? But we could say like, my patience to just, it's okay to be okay with this one more period. Inconceivably helps the people in the truck going by on school street. If we try to get a hold of exactly how that works, then it becomes like extraordinary. Maybe not so helpful. May any merit arising here today be offered freely throughout the universe to benefit all beings. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it.